about Native theater, I always think about, you know, telling a story for your community in that moment that they need in the way that best serves them. And I think when you really focus on that, there's just so many more possibilities, because it's not about being in a space in a theater that has nice seats. It's not about there being a separation between the audience and the speaker. It's not about any of that. It's about just figuring out the best way to share stories in a way that can heal community together. And that has infinite possibilities.
That is theater maker and citizen of the Mohegan Nation, Madeline Syatt. And this is Artworks, the weekly podcast from the National Endowment for the Arts. I'm Josephine Reed. Madeline Syatt is a playwright, performer, and director of new plays, classic work, and opera. Among her honors have been a TED Fellowship, an MIT Media Labs Director's Fellowship, a National Director's Fellowship, and a White House Champion for Change Award. Madeline Syatt is first and foremost an advocate for and participant in Native theater, championing Native playwrights, directors, and performers. She builds worlds on stage, directing powerful stories from a diversity of Native writers from many nations, and bringing their words to Indigenous and non-Indigenous audiences. When she directs classic work, she interrogates it by foregrounding the voices of the previously unheard, interrupting gender identity, and presenting work through an Indigenous lens. Her staging of The Winter's Tale, for example, features an all-Native multi-generational cast, while her direction of The Tempest gives Caliban his language back, and it's Mohegan. Madeline grew up with traditional Mohegan stories and Shakespeare, and it's this intersection that informs her exhilarating and intimate one-woman show, Where We Belong. Madeline both wrote and performs in the play, which is presented by the Woolly Mammoth Theatre Company in association with the Folger Shakespeare Library. Where We Belong is Madeline's journey, examining her time when she was living in London, working on a PhD in Shakespeare, and becoming increasingly uncomfortable in a country that does not recognize its colonial past. But when she returns to the United States, to Mohegan tribal land in Connecticut where she lives, she finds it difficult to feel grounded again.
For the first time in my life, my feet didn't feel rooted to the ground correctly. Up until then, whenever I'd come home, it was as if like the relationship I had to place was so deep. My feet just sort of like sunk in and rooted like all the way down to my ancestors whenever I came home. And this time I came home, something was different. I felt a little bit more distanced. I felt a little bit more up in the air everywhere I went. And the name of my people, Mohegan, means wolf people. And my name in Mohegan, Tokais, means blackbird or the dark one who flies apart. And so I was thinking about this journey from being a wolf to being a bird. And I was trying to process that. And I was also trying to process Mohegans have such a complicated history with English as our colonizers. I was leaving this 21st century England where they have socialized healthcare and companies can't put poison in your food. And some of these protocols that actually, you know, are much more community minded than in America. And I was grappling with this question of, as a Mohegan person, does missing England make me a traitor? And that was the initial impulse from which the story came, alongside gathering together a series of stories around this question of wolf to bird journey, the way that you would in traditional storytelling, just a person sharing stories in space and seeing what happened if you bring these stories together. Now, all of that sounds very complicated, but ultimately what it turned into is this piece that both navigates how my journey to the UK intersects with those of my ancestors who had to go across the ocean in the 1700s, as well as the journey of a wolf becoming a bird, as well as the intersections of language, Shakespeare, and colonialism. And so it's like the nightmare of pieces to describe, because it's not really designed to have a logline. Where We Belong was really supposed to be as much a question as anything else. This piece was never designed to give you answers. It was really about, you know, what does it mean in the 21st century to be an Indigenous person in a globalized context, you know, and so many other things that it's one of those pieces where I feel like I will never find exactly the right way to describe it.
Well, you know, you've said that you don't want to dwell on answers. You're much more interested in exploring questions in all of your work. And in fact, even on Facebook, you said,
I'm not doing any more statements. I'm just throwing questions out.
I did. I was a very long phase.
I think that's a wonderful way to come at work.
What happened was the reason the questions thing started on Facebook, it's funny that you mentioned that, was actually because we were in this moment where things were feeling very divisive. I think I started doing the questions thing in 2015 or 2016. And what I found was people would just come together in this really interesting way. Even though they didn't know each other, they would have these like long debates. Sometimes they'd be really open, like, what is time? Or like, you know, like things that like couldn't be answered. Like usually it was intentionally questions that couldn't be answered that I was grappling with in some way in my artistic work. And I'd post them and all these people from all over the place would come together and grapple around these things. And that's really what Where We Belong is aiming to do. Like a lot of my creative work, you might learn something from it, but it's definitely not geared toward being educational or a lecture. It's really geared toward like, what does this bring up for you? Because some of my most positive experiences of audience members witnessing it have been the ones who then go, oh, now I feel like I can do this with my stories. You know, they make them think about their own stories and their own life a little bit deeper and grapple with the questions of the piece a little bit more. Because I'm just not interested in like what I as one person have to say, but I'm interested in like in the questions that I'm asking in my life, what those questions might bring up for other people.
Well, you begin your show with Nan Sunan. Who is she? And tell us why you began there.
Sure. Actually, each version of the show is a little bit different. It's structured with a prologue and an epilogue. The reason there's a prologue and an epilogue is because the prologue for every single place in which it's performed is supposed to locate you in place. And the epilogue is the moment in time that we're in. So in the case of the DC version of Where We Belong, in DC, we are on the lands of the Piscataway. And I thought it was really important for people to not just be hearing my story, a Mohegan story from somewhere else, but to know there are many, many more stories in the place that they live, you know, in that land that they should be listening to. Nan Sunan was one of the last traditional chiefs of the Piscataway in the 1700s. And I start with her because Piscataway scholar and historian Gabby Tayac told me a story about her. And think about how many people not only would have never heard the story of Nan Sunan if Gabby Tayac wasn't doing this new research on it, but that also it would never have occurred to that there were female chiefs in DC prior to the advent of the United States, right? That women actually lost rights when the United States was created. That prior to that, female leadership was normal. Or that they don't even know that they're on Piscataway land, right? So what does awakening these relationships to place do for people and for each place the story's in? Because it's wonderful to be able to tell Mohegan stories, you know, stories that haven't been heard. But if I'm on someone else's land, I should be honoring and paying respect to the people whose land that I'm on. And in the case of William Emma Theater Company and the Folger Shakespeare Library, we're on Piscataway land. And so it's the Piscataway Nation and their history that needs to be the beginning point for the story.
Well, obviously, the issues that you raise in this about yourself, about Mohegans, about language and erasure and colonialism are very serious and very thought-provoking, but you also use humor a lot, especially in the voice of your mother.
Yeah, it's funny. A lot of those, funny you mentioned my like problem, my like spending time on Facebook with my art, because it's like a lot of those conversations, honestly, when I started incorporating my mom into the play, it was like I had been doing like conversations with my mom 101 each time a conversation like that happened, and I had been putting them on Facebook. And so I just went back and I was like, what are some of these conversations? I mean, that's actually the hardest thing about doing it online is that when we did it live, there was like so much laughter in the first half of the play. And I was like, oh my God, is this going to be just be like really sad with no people? Because I'm just like up there talking to myself. You know? Yeah, there's a lot of humor. I mean, one, I think that humor is necessary when talking about certain things. But two, I just am not someone who takes myself very seriously, you know, and humor is a big part of how I interact in the world in general. It's sort of that like ability to flip something on its head, you know, because some of the things that are jokes, like maybe to someone else could be serious, but it's a matter of like the framing, you know, that the beginning of the play, probably to the middle of the play, you know, it starts pretty warm. I like things that flip from comedy to serious very quickly. And I think that that also helps us listen better. You know, I think that if we're warm and we're open and we're laughing, then we're in a space where we're more capable of receiving certain things. And I think the reasons people really like the mom section so the humor is because like mom, I'm not saying like moms are all the same, but like there are things I think that my mom does, you know, that while they're very specific to her being my mom and being Mohegan, there is a version of for other people.
It resonates.
Yeah, exactly. That resonates.
You mentioned this, but that's exactly what my next question is going to be. This current production is streaming. You've performed this live, and I'm curious about the challenges of performing this without an audience for a camera.
Oh yeah, it was very challenging. I mean, it was, okay, so it was, I'm really, really appreciative of how well the film turned out. But at the beginning I was like, this is insane. Because in addition to the fact that there's no audience, the lighting for film has to be quite a bit darker. And so for most of the time I was standing alone in the dark, you know, talking to myself. And I was like, this is the opposite of what I envisioned when I initially created this. Because when I initially created this, it's so much about the exchange with the audience and the people and that story medicine of like, I am sharing words with you. And there's a cycling that's going through, you know, in terms of like what the audience is bringing to the show. I kept saying like, oh, there needs to be an audience. But at that moment of the pandemic, having an audience really wasn't possible. And so we kept brainstorming different ways of dealing with this throughout. Honestly, it was pretty funny, like the spectrum of ideas that came up. Like at one point we were going to try and have like a Zoom audience on a teleprompter that I could talk to. There were so many different things. It was really hard because it's not like a film where there's a scene partner, you know, and it's not even like a film where I talk to the camera. It's a multicam shoot of me doing a show in a theater to no reaction, which is very strange and very isolating. And so, and also because it was being filmed, there couldn't be any verbal reactions either. So it was, had to be silent. I was like, guys, this is really hard. I asked Maria Goyanis and man, Tio, the director, if they could just, this is going to sound really ridiculous, but I think it's a good lesson for collaborators. I was like, can you like just interpretive dance some response to me during the piece so I just know I'm not alone? And so they came up with like gestures for like laughing and like being with you. So just so that I had something that was there in the space with me, because I felt so crazy talking to myself for 80 minutes. And it made such a difference just to have someone out there responding. But then also in the epilogue, the section that takes place during the pandemic, acknowledging the now of what was April 2021, there's a really beautiful shot where the camera actually turns around with me and you see the empty audience. And I actually find that really moving. I find it really moving, especially hoping that we move forward and away from that moment, you know? But thinking about what it was like in that space, in that moment where we were all trying to tell stories and telling them separately, it's strange, you know, it's a very weird thing. And I do realistically with this show really long to be back around people again. But I also think about the accessibility that is afforded to this production.
Exactly. That was my next question. You know, suddenly this new opportunity too.
Yeah, definitely. And for Native theater, it's been huge because so much of our communities are in different locations, you know, that actually this whole pandemic time period for Native theater has been so interesting. You know, sometimes we have a reading online that in New York would have had 20 people come and 2,000 come instead, you know, just because that accessibility is there in a way that it wasn't before. And it means that like I can have a workshop for Native youth where they come from all over. And that's true for this as well. And so I'm really grateful because I feel like a lot more Native people will definitely see it because of the fact that it's online. Yeah. So I'm curious to see what that ends up meaning, you know, that it's not really in DC the way that it would have been before.
And you were able to virtually bring other Native theater makers, directors, playwrights to be able to talk about Native theater and create community around that.
Yes. The one thing that's so sad about where we belong is, you know, it's you don't have like a whole big group of people to work with the way that you normally do in Native theater. But Maria Goyanis was so understanding when I said, hey, we need to do a workshop with other people. It can't just be me all the time. And so she created a space in which I could bring in Tara Moses, Madeline Hutchins, Kenny Ramos, Aaron Tripp, and have other people read the work and talk about it. Other, you know, Native theater artists. And that was just so transformational. Theater, I don't know, it's not really meant to be done in isolation, you know, it's meant to be done in community. And then to have the extra layer of not having an audience there, all the ways we could create community online over the course of this process were just so important. And I'm really excited to see now that it's out there, you know, what that means now. Like, you know, are there ways that it's shared and the sharing of it creates community? It's so hard for me to imagine. We're so new to everything about the way this moment has changed the way we think about theater.
It's a lovely collaboration between Woolly Mammoth Theater and the Folger Shakespeare Theater, which is so unusual, but also great.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's also, you know, it's funny because it's like those are two institutions too that I think someone at one point said like they're not the two institutions you think about as collaborating, because like Woolly's known for like, you know, kind of like risky, innovative new plays, and Folger's obviously known for Shakespeare. But I think all institutions right now are really in this position where they have to grapple with this past year of social and political reckoning and what it means to be making art, you know, going forward, and what it means to be telling stories. And the Folgers, I could tell now, is also really thinking about what does it mean to educate, and how do we pair different ways of thinking within even our Shakespeare curriculum, and what is our responsibility to that. And so this pairing is really interesting and exciting to me, because so much of my work has been around these intersections, and seeing these like really important institutions come together and ask these questions in this moment just feels like such a step forward.
You're a member of the Mohegan Nation, as you said. Your mom is a medicine woman, and you've said storytelling was just so important to your family and your community as well.
Yeah. So growing up, I was really raised with this understanding of story medicine, that, you know, stories aren't neutral. I mean, they're often used as a part of healing practices, not just in my culture, but around the world. And what that, you know, always made me think of is the fact that stories have power. You know, you can't just tell a story and expect it not to do anything. If you're actually wielding a story, it can create great healing, or it can create great harm. And so our accountability to our communities and how we tell stories, how a story is told for the community, not for ourselves, is very important in thinking about what we're doing and how we do it and why. And so all of my work with Shakespeare has really been grappling with that as well as a director. If we're going to do this play that is more than 400 years old, like, why are we doing it, and how are we doing it, and what is our accountability to our community in this moment? And I think that there are some things in Shakespeare that really serve that. You know, some of his greatest speeches are question-based, right? They are that staring out into an audience and asking a question, like, to be or not to be, wherefore art thou Romeo, and like not answering it, but like grappling with it in front of the audience in a way that brings people together. But there are other moments where some of the language and ideas no longer serve us. And so how do we interrogate that in the actual production of the work is really important to me, because I mean, I believe that the stories we pass down shape our collective possible futures. And so we have a responsibility to care for how things move forward, what we carry forward and what we leave behind, and to be very intentional about that, because of my deep belief that these stories are going to impact the world around us. And we can't just be kind of lazy in our relationship to that. Yeah. And also growing up, traditional stories were a big part of my upbringing because of the fact that my family had founded a Tanaquijan Indian Museum in the 1920s, which is the oldest Indian owned and operated museum in the country. And so I was also used to not only ushering stories amongst ourselves, but also what it means to share stories of our people with outsiders.
When did you first become interested in theater?
It's a really good question. It's hard to say, because when I was like, you know, 6 or 7, I was already going to see outdoor Shakespeare and had already read the complete works. And I was already used to, like, you know, being a part of our traditional stories and all of that. So it's hard to say when I first became interested in theater. I mean, because we also, you know, like many a very lucky child had like a puppet show under the stairs situation as well. But what's interesting to me is that when I was a kid, I didn't know that there was native theater. I knew we had our traditional stories and I knew there was theater, but I didn't know there was a place where they intersect. And I think about that a lot, because right now I'm one of the co-artistic directors of Red Eagle Soaring Native Youth Theater in Seattle, as well as the executive director of the Yale Indigenous Performing Arts Program, which are both programs dedicated to serving Native youth in theater. And I think like, whoa, if I had gone to a Native youth theater instead, like, how would that have transformed the way that I actually make art? You know, if I didn't think that I had to do it through Shakespeare. I was constantly obsessed with different forms of storytelling, you know, whether it was painting or writing songs or writing stories. That was my entire childhood. But honestly, it was really being good at Shakespeare that gave me accessibility to theater, and how I started getting big parts was actually like the fact that I was good at speaking Shakespeare. And so I'm very aware of sort of some of the privileging around like that language and your ability to use it. But I'm also aware that, you know, it wasn't until my final year of college that I found out there were Native plays. And at that point, I had been almost ready to quit theater because I was getting so frustrated with like some of the dissonances of the American theater at that time, you know, and the patriarchal white people sitting on couches plays that were kind of operating, and how it wasn't actually the thing that I wanted to do at all. And then I was lucky that there happened to be this course in Native American theater at NYU being taught by Carmen Lara Eli, who's a Native professor there at the time. And it changed my whole world to know that we had our own canon, our culture could be centered in the conversation. And then that also it led to me volunteering to go up and do a reading of a Bill Yellowrobe play that summer. And when I did that play, it was like everything had changed. It was like suddenly everything went so much deeper. I ended up rolling into doing a master's actually looking at addressing issues of Indigenous representation on stage, because I was so mortified that this wasn't something that was being talked about, you know, that the fact that the Indigenous theater of this country was silenced in this way was not being talked about. And now obviously so much has changed in the last 10 years. And I'm so excited to see the prevalence of Native theater happening everywhere. But yeah, it was interesting because when I was a kid and I got into theater, it was very much about having to be someone else. You know, it was like, okay, well, I'll be someone else. I'll go on these adventures. And then it's so funny to me that, you know, the first time I ended up performing at Shakespeare's Globe doing Where We Belong, right? So instead of like going off and doing Shakespeare, I was actually doing Where We Belong, right? Which was the complete opposite of anything I would have imagined then. And yet there's something to be said for speaking these stories that haven't been heard that still need to be.
Well, in your career, you've both reinterpreted classics from an Indigenous perspective and given voice to Native American stories on stage. Mm-hmm. And I'd like you to talk about both of these impulses and how they align and where there's perhaps some challenges between them.
Yeah. So Where We Belong is the first thing I wrote that was, you know, like deeply personal in a kind of mortifying way where I'm like, feel like I'm very exposed. But prior to that, a lot of my work, I think, was working with and reimagining and adapting classics because they were stories that I knew, but I thought, oh, what if this character was just a little bit more visible? Or what if we saw it through this other perspective? Or what if we dismantled the hierarchy in this piece? What would that do? You know, where I was interested in sort of intervening into the systems at play to see how we could change. I've always been really interested in world building. A big part of the reason I became a director and moved away from acting was because the difference between the limitations of a world other people decide you get to exist in and knowing that you could actually imagine forward the kind of world you want to build. So thinking about some of these ideas is how I help, you know, sort of reshift and reimagine the classics in conversation with the original, sometimes very, very close to the original, just moving around certain ideas and a kind of accountability to decolonizing systems. But then with Native plays, it's just, I read this play today. I have to tell you, it's the best play I've ever read. I swear. It was this new play called Snag by Tara Moses. And it's part of a cycle she's working on. I was also, I'm directing her play Arbika for our new play festival right now. And she wrote this prequel to it called Snag. And honestly, it's a Native rom-com, but it's so good. And you know, part of the reason I think it's like so mind-blowingly exciting to like laugh and cry and read it is because those don't get produced. Do you know what I mean? Like it hasn't been encouraged. When Native theater does get to happen, it's like about our history or about our trauma, because there was so much silence around that for so long that needed to be sort of the first thing that, you know, opened up and got spoken to. Whenever I'm working on Native theater, I feel like I'm just so amazed and empowered, because the thing is that I'm usually working in this exchange between Native nations, which is like an act of diplomacy in and of itself, where, you know, non-Natives don't realize sometimes that because of all of our cultural differentiations, it means that there's like so much specificity and nuance and language in so many of these plays where you're really learning about an entirely new way of seeing the world with each one, and things that haven't been staged at a time when, you know, like, you know, there was a period, I feel like, where American theater was starting to feel like too much the same. And then now it's like cracked open. And there's just like so much possibility. And it's so, so exciting, because each one of these plays is an act of sovereignty, an act of creative sovereignty, of reminding people that like each nation, each Indigenous nation is its own sovereign state. And so everything within the works of that nation is like an expression of culture in an incredibly unique way. And this play, Snag, is so funny and heartwarming and all of these things. And 10 years ago, it would have been completely absurd, because like there wasn't even Native theater being produced. And now the idea, like coming up on also, right, like Rutherford Falls being produced this season, there was so much joy in witnessing that and witnessing Native humor without it having to explain itself, that now I feel like so much has been cracked open. Now I'm so excited about like the more joyous worlds we can build because we've broken through some things in terms of representation.
You mentioned that you're the executive director of the Yale Indigenous Performing Arts Program. Can you just briefly describe what the mission is here, but also how you guided that program through the pandemic?
Yeah, sure. So the mission of the Yale Indigenous Performing Arts Program is to promote Indigenous arts and perspectives, both at Yale and throughout Indian country. And what's really great about that program is it serves Native students and it serves the Native theater field. So it's not really beholden to Yale drama or to non-native theater. It's actually really a space where we can think about what are the needs of the youth and what are the needs of the field and how do we create programming that serves that. And during the pandemic, it was really transformational because instead of the programs being sort of elitely confined to who can show up on campus at Yale, every program became available to Native people, whoever could come online. And it created a real space that way for youth to gather together, but also not just youth, right? Because we created programmings that were playwriting programs that weren't just for youth, that were for all ages, really opening everything up. How can we create workshops and opportunities that are open to all Native artists who want to like learn a new skill set, who want to gather, who want to make something? And so it's just been really exciting, actually, this year to really think about what can be done virtually to bring people together in ways that being in person couldn't, and how to actually build on that for the future, because we actually like dynamically increased our programming during the pandemic instead of the other way around.
Yeah. If you think about if theaters went back to the roots of Indigenous theater and storytelling, what would that look like?
Yeah, it's a great question because, I mean, so when I think about Native theater, I always think about, you know, telling a story for your community in that moment that they need in the way that best serves them. And so it's a really great question, the way that you just posed that, because it's like, that is sort of what we were doing in the pandemic. You know, you wouldn't think about it as being the same thing because you think about like a fire and you think about us all gathered on a fire. And I remember there were actually conversations I had for like ever with the MIT Media Lab way long before the pandemic, thinking about this idea of scaling storytelling and the intimacy of storytelling, you know, and what technology would be involved in that. And then of course the pandemic came and it was like, we're all on Zoom. That's just where we are. But just thinking about the simplicity of the necessity of gathering and how there was that moment when we all thought like it's all over, you know, last spring. And then it was within a few months, it was like suddenly people started gathering again, but in new ways. And I feel like that's really the thing, right? It's not about what we did before or doing something right or doing something in a way that is like posh. You know, it's about how do we gather together around story in a way where we can serve people by exchanging those stories in a way that we can bring people what they need. And I think when you really focus on that and those questions, there's just so many more possibilities because it's not about being in a space in a theater that has nice seats. It's not about there being a separation between the audience and the speaker. It's not about any of that. It's about just figuring out the best way to share stories in a way that can heal community together. And that has infinite possibilities that are specific to each community. And also the question too, right, is interesting with what you said of like, what does community mean? Because like in a lot of those situations, it was like dynamic and physical. It was like, you know, who you're local to. But now I feel like community can mean so many other things because there are these digital communities, there are these like national communities, there are these international communities. And thinking about what those different spaces are is also really interesting.
Yeah. And I wonder if that's one of the models to use when we think about theater and how to move forward and make the field more inclusive, more diverse, how to address issues of equity. What we learned from this time when, well, I won't say on pause because you clearly were not on pause, but it was a time for reflection and rethinking and what we might have learned.
Yeah. And it's so strange to me because, like, you know, like this time when we were on pause, I don't think I have ever been busier than during this time we were on pause. And I think a lot of it is because, you know, people weren't willing to invest like large funds and resources into Native theater, but they're more willing to with small pockets of resources. And then also Native theater was like, you know, self-generating so much within this time. I'm always surprised when I find out about like, you know, directors and things who weren't making art during this time, because like Native theater was making so much in this last year. Like, I don't even think like people who are outside the community can realize like how much was going on that I could like never have considered this actually a pause, because the number of plays that were like developed or there were digital productions of, like, yes, we weren't together necessarily in a physical theater space, but there were audio plays, you know, there were so many different projects that were created. I mean, gosh, Native Voices at the Autry's, audio play production of Aragon Stars, The Adventures of Super Indian. I mean, there are just so many cool things that were made during this time that I think we gave ourselves permission to make because we knew we were new and messy at this medium, you know? Like, before the pandemic, I was terrified of like film and like anything that wasn't on a stage because I was like, I understand it when it's on a stage and there is an audience and like that is the relationship. That is what I understand. And I think that's a real boundary that we created for ourselves because we were scared of failing. I think that's also why we say, oh, the pause is over and we're going back to in person, right? Because we didn't fully understand these other things because we only had a year with them. But honestly, for me, it feels like a real moment of liberation to think about how we collaborate in new ways and how we actually get past that fear and those boundaries to learn how to create differently instead of just only doing what we're already comfortable with.
I agree. So tell me, what is next for you now?
I'm currently in a workshop of Arbika by Tara Moses for Native Voices at the Autry. I am about to start a new position this fall as a clinical assistant professor in the English department with the Arizona Center for Medieval and Renaissance Studies at ASU, which I'm really excited about, but also Where We Belong, it seems like, is going to have potential future life separate from the streaming. And so a lot of it's navigating that. The pandemic's been interesting for me because I switched a lot from director mode to writer mode during this time. And so there's a lot of writing projects I'm currently working on. I've been working on this piece with Border Crossings in London on specifically this period of time Pocahontas Motueka was in London leading up to her murder and how some of those interactions with the Virginia Company actually serve as the foundations of capitalism as we know it. I've been working on this piece for the Vineyard, this mini commission called The Fish, which is like an allegorical reinterpretation of the Noah's Ark story. And I'm creating this new decolonized adaptation of Peter Pan called The Neverland that looks at it, this concept, breaks down the original colonial structures and puts it through an indigenous futurism lens for the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. And so those are all things that I have to write in the next few months. but I'm also directing alongside it and still teaching and all of that. So it's really, really been really exciting. And I'm just so grateful for all of the collaboration opportunities.
And I can't wait to see the results of them. Madeline, thank you so much. I thought Where We Belong was a wonderful piece of theater. It was thought-provoking. It was funny. It opened up conversations. And it was beautifully staged.
Thank you. Yeah, it was. Everyone put a lot of thought into it. And there was also a lot of respect of understanding that this was a culture that I was coming from that was very specifically Mohegan culture. And so I knew what the symbols and protocols were, but other folks didn't. And there was a lot of thought and care around that and the respect for that. And I'm really excited to see what people think and hopefully to get it back on stage soon.
Yeah, me too. Thank you so much for giving me your time. I really appreciate it.
Of course. Thank you.
That was Mohegan theater maker Madeline Syette. We were talking about her one-woman show, Where We Belong, presented by the Woolly Mammoth Theater Company in association with the Folger Shakespeare Library. It's streaming until July 11th. Get more information at woollymammoth.net. You've been listening to Artworks, produced by the National Endowment for the Arts. I'm Josephine Reed. Stay safe, and thanks for listening.